Hello, good evening. I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Did you know all our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and new also on the Internet Archive, archive.org. We got a really fun and informative event tonight, a roundtable discussion about the 1980s Renault Cup, a supporting series to the IMSA GT that put more than 50 stock Renaults, first Le Cars, then Alliances, and later Encores, on the track, battling for what was then big money in the championship. John Bishop coined the phrase, rolled and continued, as these guys sometimes flipped and finished sometimes. Tonight we have a group of Renault Cup winners, all of whom went on to bigger and better things in racing. We have tonight John North, Charlie Downs, Rick Kneckel, Lance Stewart, Mitch Wright, Mark Mitchell, and probably a few more. Dave Coleman has joined us this evening, and he started this whole thing. Incidentally, when you start to speak, please identify yourself, as not everyone, including me, remembers your voice. So we'll start this off with our producer, Dave Wallen. He wrote the book, Showroom Stock, that covers Renault Cup and many other things in detail. So, audience, please mute your phones, and here's Dave.
Well, thanks, Trish. A little bit about the Renault Cup. You know, I covered it in my book, Showroom Stock. I still have some copies available on our website, racinghistoryproject.com, so please buy the book. And we got the inventor of the Renault Cup pretty much here with us tonight, Dave Coleman. So I'm going to let him tell us about it. Dave, you're up. Dave Coleman.
Yes. Go ahead.
Your turn. Talk about how you started this.
Well, correct one thing. You said my
Hello, Larry DeLude here.
Hello, Larry.
Hey, Larry. How you doing,
hey,
Larry?
Go ahead. I'm happy to be here.
Dave, you got Dave here. Look, in any case, 1981, I spent the whole year not racing, but running up and down the East Coast soliciting members to an organization that wanted to start a one-mark series that did not require that you had to travel the full length of the width of the country in order to be competitive for the championship, which is what was required in the Volkswagen Bilstein Cup. Any of us would have been glad to run that, but there were only about six guys that were able to be able to cover that series in such a way that they had a chance for a championship. So about 2 o'clock one morning, my radio sedan crew chief and I were sitting around my apartment and just hashing over what would it take to get something going that would be competitive, affordable, preferably in a showroom stock. Obviously, it quickly was narrowed down to a one-mark series. We wrote up about a 6 or 7 page proposal of what we wanted to do after we'd gathered, say, a dozen or two of ex-showrooms, or not ex-showroom stockers, but showroom stockers from the North Carolina region, the D.C. region, and the Carolina region for the most part. There were some from Minneapolis, there were Doug Farah, and who won the first showroom stock national championship. Anyway, there was a few others, but that was where most of the guys got together. So we wanted to be able to guarantee the sanctioning body, which had not been chosen at the time, nor had the car. We wanted to guarantee the manufacturer and John that we could guarantee that there would be anywhere from 25 to 35 cars at the very first race. So we had each of the people that got in on it to begin with, they put up a $300 bond and an additional $50 to help cover the expenses that it took to promote this thing. The deal was if they didn't show up, assuming that the rules didn't get changed too radically to violate what we had requested, they would lose their $300 bond. I learned something on that deal. I had a couple people tell me, well, $300, that's no big deal. It sort of was, but they made a point that if somebody was going to sit down and write a check for whatever my amount, they were serious, or they wouldn't have bothered to sit down and write a check. Well, I had about 25 or 30 people before it finally came to fruition. We sent out these requests for proposals, telling them what we wanted to do. We went to Toyota, Datsun, Ford, three or four others, Honda, and Renault. The only one that came back with any kind of positive response was Renault. We didn't even get it. Some of them didn't even bother to respond to us. The others basically said thanks, but no thanks. In any case, about midway through 81, latter part of 81, we began to cement a relationship with Renault. They knew exactly what this deal was about because they'd been doing it in Europe for years and years and years. They knew exactly what a Renault Cup needed to be like. We stressed on them that we wanted to have a series such that you didn't have to travel all the way across the country. Our proposal was initially that you would only count, say, 6 out of 10 races or whatever, which was not a new idea. It's just, unfortunately, it's one that promoters don't like. And so that was difficult to make fly and didn't. But they came back with a rather interesting proposal from Renault, and that was B. Clar, who I was dealing with at the time. He was their competition director, and a really nice guy. Got a great rapport with B. In any case, he came up with the idea of, well, let's start on the East Coast. We'll do an East Coast series. If it's successful, we'll go to the West Coast. At the time, the RFI was the only model available, so we were stuck with the RFI. The alliances weren't out in time. So if they went to the West Coast, by that time they'd have the alliance. So that's how you guys on the West Coast managed to get the have a better car, so to speak. One less prone to the rollover issues. So we had to get a sanctioning body, and we had been in discussions with I had a rapport ever since 1970 with John, and on any number of issues, any number of classes, and whenever I called, he always took my call. I had not raced in IMSA for a few years. I had gone short of stock, but still, he took my call, and I explained to him what we wanted to do, and I could just hear the gears rolling around his head. He's going, this is absolutely nuts. He said, but I'll consider it. So in April of 81, he asked for B. Clar and myself to meet with him at Road Atlanta and discuss it. So the three of us were in John's motorhome. And he looked at B and he said, B, nope. He said, why in the world would anybody want to run a series that only had one car, one make a car in it? And he said, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. And I just don't understand why anybody would want to do it. And at that time, frankly, John had virtually no knowledge about Sherman stock or the Volkswagen Bilstein Cup Series just was completely foreign to him. But he was so enthusiastic about it that John obviously said, well, if you're that convinced that you guys want to do it, you're obviously in a position to put up a bunch of money. So I'll be glad to try to accommodate you. He said, but you know, you're going to have to race on Saturday. We're not going to be able to fit you in on Sunday. And, you know, we don't understand why you want to do it, but okay. B said, I don't care if there's not a single person up on the hill watching this mess. He said, we want to do this for the ink, strictly for the ink. And John said, okay, well, that's the deal. Well, we didn't do more than one or two races, and the promoters wanted us on Sunday. And if you've seen the picture of the very first race that was held at Road Atlanta, you'll notice that there wasn't anybody working on their cars up in the paddock. They were all down at the fence watching the start of this race. As another aside, during that conversation with John, I told him that we had at least 25 to 35 guaranteed starters for his inaugural race, which was something kind of new because they had actually started a few classes where they had as few as four cars that ran the very first race. So he was definitely interested in the fact that we could produce the car count. And one of my last comments to him was that if they didn't screw the rules up too bad to where people would start bailing out because they weren't happy with, in other words, they didn't stick with what the original agreement was. I told him, I said, John, if you don't screw this up, we'll have possibly as many as 50 cars at that very first race. And he looked at me like I was nuts. 51 cars took the green flag exactly 1 year to the day of that meeting. And needless to say, he was a little chagrined. He couldn't believe it. And that was after we had rolled about half a dozen.
For a minute there, Dave, which of you guys were there at the first race? Charlie Downs and Mitch, any of you guys do the first race?
Roberto Lorenzuti.
Huh?
Go ahead.
Or Mitch?
No, I did the West Coast.
I was there at the first
start.
Race.
Yeah, I didn't start.
Larry Delude here. I was at the first race.
Yeah, I was in Atlanta. Lloyd Washington, Charlie Down, and myself, we drove all the way from Brooklyn to Atlanta.
Is that Roberto? Good to hear from you.
Same here. It's nice to get together after so many years.
That's
Roberto, Reggie, glad here. I didn't race, but I was there with you guys.
Is that Reggie?
Yeah, that's me, Larry.
All right. Good to hear from you, too.
I've been checking for you, man.
That's the first race what that was all about. That must have been exciting and terrifying and boring at the same time.
Yeah, but I knew he was going to work. It was a great idea.
I remember when we went with Charlie and Lloyd Washington to Pennsylvania when Renault did a meeting in a little garage. They present the car, and of course I start open my mouth and say all the things was running the car, and who was one of the doors. I say I need a sun candelax in the door, the seat I need to be replaced, and the tires are too big. Well, I was the first guy who I tested, and I got a free aero. Helicopter flight to the hospital.
Mm. Yeah.
But that was Kirk Rorick. I was four, I think so. And Kirk Rorick hit me in my rear, right in the downhill. And I went over the guardrail and down all the way down. And the other side of the truck. But anyway, that was the first day.
And you fixed the car and kept on racing all year, is that right?
What?
You fixed the car and kept on racing it, or was it destroyed?
No. In reality, what happened is when we went to the meeting, in Pennsylvania with Charlie and Lloyd, I opened the mouth and Renault told me not. And I said, well, the doors are plastic, locksmith, and the wheels, the tires are too big. And after I got the crash, of course, I went to the hospital, and I broke my scapula. Lucky I alive because the door opened when I start roll, and the seat broken because the hinges was plastic also, and my body went off out of the car. And I needed went to the hospital every day to take my blood out of my eyes. But anyway, somebody, I don't know who, say, I hear Lorenzuti go to suit Renault. And I never say that. But one day, I got a call. No, one day my wife said to me, say, we're going to dinner tonight. And we went to dinner, and was the Renault people there. And at the end of the dinner, they give me the key of a brand new Renault Le Car 5, all prepared to race. And my first race was Summit Point back after the accident. But Renault really gave me a brand new car, you know. I don't know why, but probably because somebody opened the mouth and said, I go to suit Renault because the doors, the seat, and the tires. But anyway, that's what happened. The first one we put in, we worked a lot in my shop in Brooklyn with Charlie and Lloyd. And really, we drove the cars to Road Atlanta. But that was the old times. Right now, you need it. And was incredible, wonderful race. A bunch of, I meet a lot of good people, and I'm happy I did it, you know. And it's a million things to I can say with the Renault Cup, but you guys too. It's nice to talk to you guys. Now somebody else needs to say something.
Well, listen, who was the guy who got over the guardrail and into the pit lane at Summit Point in 1982?
What?
Do you remember that?
I can't hear you.
Somebody got tangled up on the front straight there at Summit Point and came over the guardrail and into the pit lane upside down.
That was Dave Rosenblatt.
No. The only time I crashed in the Renault Cup was because I got hit by Rorik. And really happened to that when we went to Minnesota to race. I don't know if you guys remember when we went to what is the racetrack in Minnesota?
Brainerd.
I was winning, leading the race, but I got it in my right behind me, Kurt Rorik, and I was a little scared. He got to hit me again, and he passed me right before the finish line. But no, I don't remember who crashed in Summit Point.
Yeah, I remember that.
A funny story connected with that. So I was there with a girlfriend who didn't know anything about racing and thought it was dangerous, and I told her it wasn't. And then this car came over the pit fence and rolled down the pit lane, and I think that was the last I saw of her. But anyway, that was 82. Where were you, Charlie Downs? You were there in 82, right?
While you're waiting on Charlie, that car that went over the guardrail into the pits over at Summit Point was Dave Rosenblum.
Dave Rosenblum was the first guy who rolled the Renault by himself in Road Atlanta, the first race.
Well, there may have been more.
That was in practice. That was in practice.
Yeah,
I was the guy that rolled in the race.
The guy that rolled it at Summit Point, I don't know his name, but he was a friend of Dave Rosenblum's. His nickname was Moose, but I don't remember his real name.
Might have been one Dave of the Rosenblum. Racing kids there.
Listen, Ray, Dave Rosenblum, in that time, he don't have no friends.
Yeah.
They must have photoshopped the picture I have of it then.
Well, I need to say, I'm still friends with Dave, and we see each other, we ski together. It's still the same, don't change.
Yeah.
But anyway,
Tommy, you are there.
Speaking of rolling, how many of y'all have actually flipped it? I guess all of you have flipped one at some point.
Twice.
I rolled mine three times.
Anybody ever get hurt? I don't want to hear about it if you did, but I hope not.
Not enough to keep me out of the next race.
Those little things were built right, weren't they?
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, they didn't crush you.
These were pre-Hans device.
I know that.
Yeah.
I know that. Yeah, it was about 3 or 4 years ahead of the Hans.
You guys who won in 82, Charlie, I don't know where Charlie is, I called him back, and Mitch, you guys have to go to France for the World Championship or whatever it was?
This is Mitch, right? I didn't start running until 83.
Okay. Was that the year that you went to France?
I went to France in 83.
Yeah.
83 and 84, I went 2 years.
How did you do?
I was...
How'd you finish?
Well, I was the highest placing American both years. I was 11th 1 year and 12th to 13th 1 year. I don't remember which year was which. But it was a hell of a lot
That's
of fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
How many cars on the track? What was the field like?
Oh shoot! There had to be at least 50 cars.
Yeah. Well,
we ran a different car there. We ran the R5 Turbo. It was a turbocharged version of the R5 that.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, so it had, instead of 50 horsepower, it had like 100.
Wow. That would be a thrill after spending a whole season in the United States.
Also, who won it? Willie Lewis went too, right?
Yeah, Willie Lewis went first in 83 with me and Charlie and Rorick and Ray Kong.
Yeah.
And then 84 was Parker, myself,
Alan Pope,
yeah. And who am I missing?
Yeah, great question. From the East, the first
Andy?
Year of Encores.
Yeah.
Andy Pilgrim?
Nope.
No, he's from the West. I don't remember.
Good grief. Wasn't it that I can picture him? Can't think of the name. Having a senior moment here, guys.
It'll come to you when you're not thinking about it. How many of you all started your racing careers in this series?
Professionally. I did. This is Rick Knuckle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it at the 82 Detroit Grand Prix. And I saw all you guys floating around the streets of Detroit, and being a Detroit native, I said, well, hell, I can do this. I had done a couple of years as Skip Barber and figured if I could do Formula Fords that are, you know, half again as fast and doing a front-wheel drive LeCard would be no problem. Boy, did I get a lesson in humility.
It's a whole different set of skills, isn't it? I know it is.
they used to drill into you at Skip Barber when you spin a Formula Ford, you know, if you spin both feet in, and that's exactly the wrong thing to do in a front-wheel drive car, which I found out about my first foray to Road Atlanta, where I put it on its head at the dip, the old dip, about four laps into practice in a torrential downpour.
Naturally, no drainage.
With a brand new $300 Simpson three-layer fire suit, and the car ended up on its roof with the red Georgia clay pouring down through the roof, through the window. And when I released myself into the roof, released the belts, I basically came out with an orange fire suit.
Yeah, and it's permanent, yes.
Yes, exactly. I still have it in my closet, but that...
Still on.
No, that... I still fit.
I apologize for Georgia clay. I'm sorry.
Well, it gets better because so we got the car back to the pits, and I, for whatever the luck of the draw, we happened to be pitted between Kurt Roerig and Willie Lewis, and so I ended up making fast friends with them, and they were very helpful in coaching. But we banged out the car, we put a new windshield in it, we get it together, and the sun clears, the weather gets better, we're going out for the afternoon practice, and about three laps into the afternoon practice, I'm coming into the little short chute before you get on the back straight at Road Atlanta, and you know, in second gear or whatever, and just fire as fast as I can go, and all of a sudden, the engine hand grenades. And, now I got smoke torn in the car, I got fire in the car, I got oil. I slide off the outside at turn, what was it, 7 is the one onto the back straight, and dive out into, again, yet another wet puddle of Georgia clay. And probably a dozen or so LeCars decide to, you know, lay down a nice oil slick there. They go sliding all over the place, and I make my way over to the corner station, and the corner workers get me over there, and there's three guys up against the fence just laughing their rear ends off. And, oh, man, you guys are putting on a hell of a show. This is unbelievable. We love this. And they're yucking it up. And I finally turned to the corner worker. I said, who are those, you know, blankety blanks? And she goes, oh, well, that's Don and Bill Whittington and a buddy. They own the track. needless to say, a couple of years later.
They've probably never seen anything like this, no.
Well, when they had their little fiasco at the start of the Indy 500 a couple of years after that, I had a special comment for those guys. But so I had less than six laps on the track and had a totally busted ass, no engine, rolled over, busted car that we put on the trailer and towed back to Michigan and spent the next 3 months repairing before the next race at Charlotte. Got a dose of humble pie pretty quickly there. You went on to win that race, didn't you, Steve, at 83 at Road Atlanta?
Yeah, I won 84 and 85. 82, I had a stone for a car, literally. That's one problem with these showroom stock cars. You get one that's not quite up to snuff, you're stuck. There's nothing you can do about it. In my first car, that was it. In 83, I had rolled a car at the last event in Pocono in 82, so I needed a car. A buddy of mine, we were sort of semi-teammates, named Rod Bannerman, he had a car that was up to snuff, so I rented it on a race-by-race basis. I had the pole position at three different tracks that year with that car. I had the pole position at Road Atlanta. Unfortunately, Willie decided that I wasn't going quite fast enough for him in turn one on the exit, and he gave me a little punt in the right rear corner, and so I went off dirt tracking on the first lap. But I thought I had it made because when we came up for the start, as we came to the bridge, I just backed out of it, and the pace car went on down the pace road, and Ken Williams was on the front row beside me, and he didn't slow down. So I just kept backing out of it and letting him get on ahead of me. He was about halfway down the hill, and he realized that he was probably going to get black flagged or whatever for jumping the start. So about that time, I gunned it and just left him in the dust. Unfortunately, it didn't work on anybody else, and we get to turn one, and Willie gave me a nudge. It worked out a little better when we got the encore. In 84, I showed up, ran as D.B. Cooper, and all the timesheets that came out.
I've heard about that.
As D.B. Cooper, and that was very interesting. That was the year that the FBI agent showed up looking for a serial killer, and there were about 30 of them that were roaming the pits up there. Everybody was joking that I was going to get yanked out of the car from sitting on the pole position. Any case,
there was a petition there for that that you didn't know about.
No doubt. But actually, I hadn't had a win. I needed one, and I was glad to get it. Unfortunately, I didn't have anywhere near the fun that I was like to, because the race for second place in that race was an absolute barn burner. So I ended up winning by about a 12-second margin, which was ridiculous. But everybody thinks I was cheating, but there's a backstory, and it has
well,
to do
there always
I
is.
Yeah. And, so, any case, apparently everybody figured out what the deal was, but it did definitely make a difference, and it had to do with the R5s having, if you ran at regular oil level in those R5s, they roll so much that in a tight turn or a long sweep turn like a carousel, you'd end up with the oil light coming on. So you ran about a half quart over. And I suspect a lot of people were running half a quart over. Hell, I hadn't even changed oil. I had 1,500 miles on that Encore. They were new. And I didn't even change the break-in oil from the factory. I was actually a little bit on the low side. Turns out that windage makes a big difference in those later cars, because when I showed up at Mid-Ohio, I had I didn't realize it at the time, but I had changed the oil by the time I got to Mid-Ohio, and I had put in a little extra like we had done with the R5s, and the car was like it had an anchor out going down the back straight, and I got to thinking about it and realized what the problem was. And got under there and drained some oil out, and the car got its speed back. So that's my story, and I'm
sorry. That's a good one.
Use your phone when you're not talking, so we don't hear your dog in the background or whatever that is.
Look, you having trouble with the audio?
Just a touch.
Hey,
just some background.
Mitchell, are you there? You went from to the Renault, or did you go from the Renault to Formula Ford? Which was the first step?
The opposite. Yeah.
You got me, Dave?
Who's running their motorcycle in the background?
Yeah, I'm hearing that too.
You can unmute yourself when you want.
Yeah, I'm not sure who that is, but
I don't either.
I actually started in Formula Ford, and then I had kind of a weird segue into the Alliance Cup. I don't know if you guys want to bore you with it, but it was pretty interesting.
Just speaking, I didn't catch it.
This is Mark Mitchell.
Oh, hey, Mark. Okay, thanks. Just needed to know.
No worries. Should I continue? I mean, I feel like I'm not worthy, because there's guys on here that won races, and I think I got a couple podiums, but, I think guys like Lance or Mitch or John would probably be the more qualified to comment, since they actually reached the top step, but I can give you my spiel if you're curious.
You,
it was,
you
it,
told
it,
you.
If you were out there, you count anybody who did it.
I think that first year for Alliance, I think I remember counting it one. There was probably at least 8 guys that came from Mulholland, like clandestine racing up on Mulholland Drive, that first year in 83, that all, this was like the clarion call for the guys that were kind of, you know, wandering between, you know, whatever, adolescence and a career, and then we all wanted to race cars, and then this thing appeared out of left field, and I'm like, God, it was just like, so I had actually been racing, I took the Jim Russell School out at Ontario Motor Speedway, and I ended up winning like the Formula Ford Festival, and it got me a scholarship to go race on the works team in England. And I was getting ready for that. You know, I'm like, Formula Ford, that's, you know, that's where it all started back then. But and then this thing, my good friend John Norris goes, hey, you know, Dave Wallen told me about this series that's coming out. And I'm like thinking, wow, man, that's pretty cool, you know. And I had a friend of mine, Gary Basil, who actually had won the festival a year earlier. And I was talking with him. He goes, don't do it unless you bring a lot more money, because you're going to get your ass kicked by the rich Brazilian kids that bring a lot of money. And he goes, but there's this, you maybe should think about that Alliance Cup, you know. And there was a guy who was running a series that he goes, I want to help you out. And he bought my car for me. So it just ended up being more advantageous. But the problem with it was I went from, like, you know, an open wheel rear drive to this 55 horsepower, you know, blankety blank that and I was a fish out of water. But I still consider that probably, you know, I mean, it definitely defines momentum car if there's nothing else out there that even comes close. But it was made some great friendships, and so, like as mentioned, so many people went on to lofts of your height.
Lois, you were around there about the same time as Mark Mitchell was, weren't you?
Yeah, it was. It was John Norris here. I remember actually, yeah. You're the one who talked them to it. I was great. I met you when I was racing RS. I did a couple of RS races in my Capri, and that was my start in racing. And I remember you telling me, like, you got to go try this Renault Cup. And I thought, well, I don't know. He said, they're racing the Alliances next year. They're cheaper to race. I go, why is that? Because they roll over less. So, sounds good. So I started, yeah, Lance and I started with Uzetta AMC in, East LA, and it was great. It was awesome. $7,000, you know, $1,000 down, and I don't know what the monthly payments were, but got to go racing.
This is Lance. Yeah, I was fortunate to team up with John, and I had met John up on Mulholland, like Mark was talking about. There was a whole group of guys. Victor Van Tress, Tommy Hughes, John Norris, Mark Mitchell, myself.
Jim Carpenter.
Trying to think who else it was.
Jim Carpenter.
Yep, Jimmy Carpenter.
Yeah.
I was fortunate. My mother actually owned the car that I drove and would drive it to work when it wasn't being raced at Hughes Aircraft in Culver City.
Hey.
So it was truly the, you know, it was truly the car that got used every day as a regular car. We would just take the side door bars out of it, and Mom would drive it to work.
Okay.
So it was a pretty good deal. And it was definitely my start in professional racing and kind of led me to everything else that I did. Certainly taught you racecraft that you won't learn anywhere else. It was absolutely unbelievable.
Hey, Lance, you remember when you learned about bump drafting?
Bump drafting, and I was just going to say, let's segue into you and John Williamson at Riverside.
That was 84, I think it was 84, the first race at Riverside, and we were running.
Right, I won that race, and that was one of the things that helped make that happen.
I was in like third place or fourth place, and Williamson was behind me, and it was looking good, because you don't really want to be in the lead on the last lap. And it was looking pretty good for drafting. Everybody's running in a bunch, and Williamson was behind me. And the TV was interviewing my dad, and it was looking pretty good. And then Williamson decided in the middle of turn 9 to take a kind of a low line early apex, but he was writing checks he couldn't cash, and basically came up to the wall. But the problem was I was between him and the wall, and he rolled over and slammed me into the wall, and I was done then. But I went to, I went on holiday back to England to see my folks, and my uncle, this is I don't know how many years ago, I saw you on TV. I go, what do you mean? Because there was a video, there was a show called And They Walked Away, and it showed you crashing to John Norris. They're like, we know him. So, my sister,
and,
oh,
and
my
let's talk about John Williamson's number. I don't know if anybody else in Renault Cup knew, but John Williamson numbered his cars by his rollovers.
Nah.
And I want to say he was 27 at that race. Does that sound right, John?
I think that sounds about right. But I remember also the next weekend was Laguna Seca. And we shouldn't speak ill of the dead, R.I.P. John Williamson. But he was kind of an aggressive guy. And he gets to Laguna Seca, and the car turns up. It rolls into the pits. I'm like, there's Williamson. He's got his car fixed. And it was all painted plain white and had his big, three big creases in the hood. And I go, John, what happened to the, what happened to your hood? He goes, that piece of shit wouldn't go into gear, so I hit it with a crowbar.
I think I was married to that guy or something. That sounds so familiar.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy.
He was a character.
We could do a show on John.
Oh, goodness.
There were some crazy, crazy races. Laguna Seca, remember, John, the giant crashes they had in one of the Laguna Seca races. They've got the entire field of the yellow flag. And somebody actually going by the emergency vehicle, the truck going to pick up whatever car it was. I think it was between turn 3 and 4. As he's going by the emergency vehicles, he ends up losing control and rolling his car under a full course caution.
I remember that race because I remember when they first spec'd the car out, they spec'd them out with too big of a rear sway bar. So you had a front-wheel drive car that oversteered but only had 53 horsepower to try and pull it back into line, and it just didn't work, and his cars would just spin out. And I remember it seemed like every lap, every corner, you come around the corner, there'd be some car in the guardrail, upside down, off the road or whatever. It just, I think there were 17 cars that DNF'd in that race just due to accidents. Crazy.
Was it Roger Yandy, the chief steward or whatever, was just furious at the entire group?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, he was so pissed off. God. And, of course, we kept going back there.
Yeah. That was my
I am supposed to do a station identification here. You want to excuse me just a second? Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen. And did you know all our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and you also on the Internet Archive, archive.org. Thank you. Okay, y'all. What's it like sharing the track with GTP cars in practice?
It was, you know what? It was so fun, you know, doing what we were doing. And I think everybody.
It felt like a pool table.
Yeah, we appreciated just being out there. We appreciated being around those guys. And we probably all harbored fantasies of, you know, we're going to get to where they are because we're racing Renault Cup, which wasn't going to have a shot in hell, but what the hell? It's what we all thought.
You could.
You sort of.
I remember one time.
Parker did it. Andy did it. Some people did it.
Yeah.
We were practicing, open practice.
Was that scary?
Really scary. Open practice of Portland. They've got a curved back straightaway. And I know we were out on the track with GTP Porsches and stuff like the 962s. And I was going past. I was going down the back straightaway. I'm watching my mirrors. Because I know they're coming and coming fast, but I can't see them because it's curved and there's a wall. So you get to the point where he's just about ready to turn into the little chicane there. And I was totally Hayward, or suddenly came flying by and missed him by inches. Would have put us into orbit if that happened.
Absolutely. That's why I'm thinking, because I've seen it happen. I've seen them out there practicing and thinking, that's a pool table out there, you know?
It was scary.
It was scary to watch. My first one that I ever saw was. Excuse me?
All of you guys pretty well went on to some kind of success in racing. And actually, when when I first had a program, I was looking for drivers. I picked guys I knew who were doing well in the Anoka. And at the back of the field, you might remember him, Joe Rouge, who was the editor of Road and Track, must have been 40th at every race he ran. And he told me, boy, that's the most fun I ever had in my life. Because the battle for 40th, trying to get to 39th, was just as tough as it was to get from third to second. And there's never been the Bilstein Cup wasn't quite that competitive either. But it was a great series. And of course, it didn't do Renault any good. And a couple of years later, I took that similar program to Mitsubishi. They were running a spec series elsewhere in Asia. And I got done with my presentation. And the problem was all the marketing people said, yeah, but you can't be using Renault as an example. It's just gone away. But it certainly worked for drivers. It didn't do much for Renault.
Well, they managed to get their hands on AMC, didn't they?
Well, yeah, they all went away.
Yeah, they did, but it took a while. It was a slow day.
Actually, was there a Renault Cup in 85 or was it 84 in the last year?
85.
Yeah, 83, 4, and 5 on the West Coast.
85 was the last year, right? And
right.
I think 86 or 87 was the last year that they sold Renaults in North America.
That's right.
Somewhere right around.
But they still continue to do Renault series in Europe.
Oh, yeah. I think they do it yet today.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Different marketing types here. When I had a race program, it went away because they decided $99 leases were a better way to go, and that nothing's changed in the last 30 years.
Yeah, it's hard to
understand. First time I saw one was in 81, 82, at Pocono. And James Reeves won it. I really enjoyed watching that. That was a lot of fun. And I didn't see another one until the next winter. Rode Atlanta.
The LeCars seemed like they were quite a spectacle.
Mitch Wright. Mitch, where
yes.
did you go from the Renault Cup? What was your next race program after the Renault Cup?
Well, I had a handful of phone calls. I did some racing for Toyo. I actually took care of Joe Roos and John Dinkle's car for the road and track.
I remember Thunderbird at Nelson Ages.
Yeah, we ran the Thunderbird. Joe and John Dinkle hooked me up with Kim Baker.
Oh, yeah.
And so we did Nelson Ledges the first year in a Bertone, or basically Fiat X19, and then went to the Corvettes from there the following years. But, you know, really, without the Renault Cup, I don't know if I would have been able to continue racing. I was broke. I had no money. I'd spent every dime I had, you know, trying to figure out how to get into professional racing. And, you know, being able to go to the bank and buy a $7,000 race car was a pretty good deal. And I had a dealer that paid my entries and bought me tires. And I drove the car down to Riverside for the first race and didn't really know what the hell we were getting into and what we found out in a hurry. It was a lot of fun. I actually qualified on the pole and finished second to Lance. And it was, you know, they talked about drafting battles and bump drafting and all. And I think everybody here can attest to the fact that, you know, driving through a windshield of 8 to 10 cars in front of you was at times could be pretty terrifying. But I think as Lance and John pointed out, I learned more about racecraft and, you know, how to maintain momentum and all in those cars than I had in anything else I'd driven up to that point by, you know, leaps and bounds. I mean, it was a good program. I actually made money the first year I ran it. I can say I made a profit owning and driving a race car, which was pretty amazing. The second year, the 84, I ended up rolling my car on Friday practice at Laguna. And, had to go rent a car and had no money to pay the rent that I car that I rented, so it was kind of a must win situation, and thank goodness I was able to pull that one off. But it was amazing. And you know, I got to tell you a quick story about our first trip to France. Or whatever year Alan Pope went. Alan, we were staying and we were in Paris. It was like the first night or second night we were there. And Marie Claire comes down and she goes, "Have you guys seen Alan?" Alan finally comes down and says, "Alan, did you get into the minibar in your room?" And he goes, "Yeah." He emptied the minibar. Literally emptied.
That's an expensive night.
Oh, man. He was also going absolutely crazy because he couldn't find a fast food place. Here we are in Paris, France, and the guy's just jonesing for a Big Mac or something. It was amazing. But as everybody has said, I have fond memories of that series, and you know, I don't think there'll ever be another one that, you know, can run as that you can race as economically as we could then and actually make a buck or two. And I think, hey, you know, the camaraderie was absolutely amazing. You know, you'd have, you know, we got to be pretty good buddies with, you know, the likes of John Norris and Lance and that whole group. And, you know, it really wasn't cliquish. And I think one of the best times we had when we all went back to Watkins Glen for the East-West shootout, and all the East Coast guys were really playing it up. You know, they drive around with surfboards on their cars, and you know, it was just fun. You know, the racing was really, really intense, but it was fun. At least it was for me. I just had an absolute ball.
Yeah. Hey, Mitch, this is Rick. I didn't think you were going to make that first Watkins Glen East Coast West Coast thing. Remember our trip through Canadian Customs?
Oh shit!
You beat me to it. I was going to ask you about that.
Well, Rick, you remember the details a lot better than I do. I just remember being hung up there and, you know, being extremely naive on what we were doing there. It was unbelievable.
So Mitch had been out to the East Coast race at Michigan International Speedway a few weeks before because they wanted to find out the drafting characteristics of the Alliance versus the Encore. So Mitch ran the weekend and then was kind enough to start at the back of the field and help tow me to quite a few cars past, I think. But long and short of it is he left his car at Renault Jeep Sport and then 3 weeks later flew out and we got together and towed out to Watkins Glen. And from Detroit, we typically went through Windsor and across Ontario to Niagara Falls. Well, we got there to customs and I had relationships with a company I worked for. We had a manufacturing plant in Windsor, so I knew all the customs people, and I could, you know, just send them a list to call them up and say I was coming through. And this time I called them, and I think told them there were two of us coming. But I think, Mitch, it had to be something about the California look. Was it Jack? Was that your crew guy, Big Jack?
Yeah.
Yeah. All of a sudden the customs guys wanted to understand what this car with California plates on it was doing crossing at Windsor going to Canada. And they were very paranoid in Canada about you stopping somewhere along the way and selling stuff off your trailer, spare parts or tools or this or whatever, right? So they pulled you guys aside and started really going through the fine-tooth comb and inspecting, and I'm not so sure they weren't looking for other things, but I just remember I just remember your wife going a little bit ballistic and talking about we're Americans and you can't do this to us, and it's like, sorry, we're in Canada. They can do whatever they want.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, the one of the prior trips to either Lime Rock or something, I had my wife or my soon-to-be wife and her daughter, my stepdaughter, with us, and we came through in the middle of the night. We had a Ford van with some tinted-out windows, and my daughter was about 5 years old at the time. She had one of these life-size dolls, you know, and it was in the back of the van, and they kept shining. How many people were in the van? We told them, are you sure about that? And so they finally went in and inspected. They thought we were trying to smuggle a kid through the – so it was always a challenge.
Trafficking, yes.
Oh, yeah. Those were the off-track memories that were, you know, like Mitch said, we had great camaraderie. We had a lot of fun and still remember these things to this day. It's pretty funny.
Oh, yeah. You know, roaming around the paddock looking to see who had a good barbecue going because I didn't have any money for food. I mean, it was – you know, we spent it all on gas.
Exactly. Or we were there. We were all there at the start of Caitlyn Jenner's career.
Yeah, you're right.
He was a hell of a racer.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, that's probably debatable. Hey, listen, Lance, where did you go from the Renault Cup? What was your next race team after that?
Well, I started driving the Honda and was able to join the Honda Firehawk and World Challenge teams and just kind of went from there. So that worked out pretty well. That was the stepping stone. That was what got me there.
That apply to you too, Mitchell? What did you do after the Minnow Cup?
I can't say that it actually elevated me to anything else, but I do know that on the heels of the Alliance Cup, the Escort Series came out, and that was, you know, the mid-80s. I know a lot of guys were able to get some rides just because of the distance of a lot of them. That was kind of like, you know, there was a lot of guys that were in Renault Cup very easily found seats in the respective, you know, the Firehawk or the SCCA Escort stuff. And actually, Lance, I mean, I'd known Lance for years. We Mulholland, you're part of that. But he actually got me on one of those gong shows out at Willow Springs, a test deal to get on the Honda team. And I survived that and I was able to kind of come drive with Lance for a couple seasons. And that was pretty magical stuff.
Well, yeah, you know,
those were some good times.
We actually came along looking for drivers, and I ended up with John Noyes, Charlie Downs, and Ray Kong. And, John, who else was in the Renault Cup that had driving with all those cars? Do you remember?
I was trying to think. You can make a huge list from all the people who went onwards and upwards from Renault Cup. You know, guys like Parker and Mitch and Andy and stuff like that. I know that was, you know, You suggested Renault Cup, and I did that, and then we remained friends. And when you started looking around for a third driver, I think for 24-hour races, I got involved with Mitsubishi with that, and kind of went from there.
Certainly, in fact, all of the front runners in the Renault Cup went on to have pretty successful racing careers. But even the guys back to the field had good racing careers where they got to drive for some team or something. It was a good place to start, and. You know, it's funny, a couple of years ago, when I wrote that showroom stock book, it came about because I met a couple of guys who wanted to know whatever happened to it. And why don't we have a series for Priuses or something? And the fact is that there's just no interest on the manufacturer part in doing some kind of race series as a promotion to sell cars. But it'll come along in the future. We may not be around for it, but sometime down the road there'll be a bunch of electric cars buzzing around and we'll stop in and put a new battery or something.
Yep, I imagine so.
I know all the funny stories from Laguna.
Okay.
I think Mitch and Lance, John, I'm pretty sure it was the first year. It was 83, and the first race for this series, the inaugural race, was at Riverside. And I think the very next weekend was Laguna. And it was referenced earlier with the big sway bar. The first practice session at Laguna, there was a carnage. A couple rollovers, just a lot of hurt cars. And I think it was Bernie Stork went to the Hertz at the airport in Monterey and rented an Alliance. And he brought it back to the pits, and you've never seen so many hungry people. And this car, it was cannibalized, and I don't think there was a wheel pointing straight on the car. Everybody got I don't know who the person was that was lucky enough to take it back to the airport, but, I mean, it was an absolute resource. There were probably a dozen racers that needed parts just to make the race. And, you know, that was the, you know, again, the beauty of that whole series is, you know, you do what you can. You can get on the track and run.
And how many of them ended up as insurance claims on the side of the road somewhere?
Well,
oh yeah,
I remember. That's another interesting. You would say it, because I remember there was. I remember at 3 o'clock in the morning, digging in Victor Hertzfelder's backyard to exhume a motor for someone who popped their engine. Now, do you remember who that was, Lance? That was Norm Breedlove's car, and he was the first casualty. The first session at Riverside. The first guy to you know, fall on his sword. His car got rear-ended in the banking, you know, Riverside, and it was done. And we, you know, kind of did what we had to do. But, I mean, I think it wasn't until, like, that was 83, and it might have been 85. Lance, did you run it in 85?
Yeah, I ran all 3 years.
Okay, so it might have been 1 or 2 years after the motor had found its place about 6 feet under that it was exhumed and put in somebody's car. We won't go into names, but I'm sure you can remember that.
Yeah. There were a lot of cars, though, that ended up being totaled and getting insurance settlements.
Yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah.
Hey,
quite a few.
Hey, guys. And haul it out and claim it happened on the highway.
Yep.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
That's the whole point.
Snowplow or something.
Yes.
Hey, guys. One of the craziest ones was 83 at Road America. And my teammate, Chuck Little, second lap of the race coming out of three, barrel rolled the car probably 8 or 9 times. And it was totally wadded up. So we tow it back to Detroit. We're sitting around because Pocono's 3 weeks away. We're out to dinner one night drinking a few beers, and somebody said, well, why don't we strip it down and rebuild it? Nah, that'd be a waste of time. Long and short of it is, after too many beers, we decided the next morning to call Renault Jeep Sport, and they go, yeah, we got a body in white out here. So that Saturday, we went out and picked up the body in white, got it back to the shop. We'd stripped the car down, everything, pulled the body in white in, started putting all the stuff from the old car onto the new car, only to find out it was a European body in white. So
perfect.
None of the mounting points fit the dashboard. None of, you know, it was a lot of improvisation to get that thing back together. But lo and behold, we showed up at Pocono. We showed up late, missed the first practice session, got there. The car was horrible. Wheels pointed in every direction known to man. But the crazier thing about it was we, you know, got the VIN plate over and put it on. Chuck ended up selling that thing a few months later to somebody, and I don't know how it ever got licensed because it was totally illegal. But that's the kind of stuff that went on.
Expired on that stuff now anyway.
Yeah,
a lot of that stuff.
Exactly. Somewhere out there.
That's what made it affordable.
Exactly.
Trish, let's wind this up, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
You sure?
We got a good complement of stories, and the people who download it and listen in their spare time.
Okie dokie. You the boss. Okay. Let me get my thing here yet. Okay, well, I think we've come to the end of another broadcasting day. And, let's see, where am I? Oh,
We're going to wish you all happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. We will see you on Wednesday, January 19th, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, and we'll be talking about Camel Lights, that exciting GTP light series with an insane collection of competitors and some seriously tall tales from that exciting era. I'd like to say I can get my boss involved in this one, but he just sort of smiles and moves away slow. He doesn't want to do these things. So if you know Jim Downing, call him and tell him to get on here. Okay, anybody got anything left you want to say before we crank it out? Have you got any questions?
Great hearing from everybody.
Anybody in the audience want to say something? With cricket.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, hey, this is Rick. I think most of you guys know I've got a Facebook page that has got a lot of pictures, you know, some pictures from back 83 to 85. It's on Facebook as IMSA Renault Cup East West.
Yeah, I follow that. Who runs that page?
I do. I run that, and with support from anybody who wants to throw stuff on there. I know Steve Coleman has done that and a few other folks out there. But
it was Steve Coleman running around with the surfboard on top of his car at the Glen.
Oh.
The light just...
Yeah, I had not just a surfboard. I had dingleberries hanging off of the...
That's right.
hanging off the roll bar and fuzzy dice hanging off the front mirror.
And you had one on the side. I remember.
Did anybody ever tell you you were a cliche? I love it. That is so perfect.
And I had wood paneling vinyl panels to make it look like a Woody.
That's right.
Yeah, it's kind of like shelf paper.
Yeah,
I know that.
Contact paper. You can get contact paper that looked like wood paneling. So for that race, I had it decked out in wood paneling. I had a surfboard on the back. And like I said, dingleberries hanging off the roll bar all the way around. And fuzzy
Did anybody
dice.
Tell you that you had invented Trump car?
people
you can claim to have invented Trump car. Oh, I love it.
That's pretty good.
Unfortunately, it didn't make it go any faster.
No, I wouldn't think so. Because the shelf paper sort of peeled off.
Hey, Trish, I'll throw this out to everybody.
Okay.
On the West Coast, on the East Coast, Renault used to bring in a celebrity, right? So, like, John Oates raced with us a couple times. Who'd you guys race with on the West Coast from a celebrity standpoint? John Oates. John Oates raced a couple of times, Lime Rock and maybe Detroit, I think, or...
I don't remember anybody, John or Mitch.
No,
I just remember a lot of journalists running the Alliance Cup. You know, I thought that spoke volumes.
Like, didn't they have like Tony Swann and Gene Lindemood and some of those guys run?
Sean Basser.
Yeah, there was quite a few journalists that took the plunge.
Didn't Pat Bedard do it?
Papadar, John Dingle, Snow, Joe Ruiz.
Joe actually owned his own car, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, yeah,
it's great talking to you. Great hearing from you. Have a good holidays.
All right.
John, thank you so much. I've enjoyed
thank
it.
You. Keep up the good
Merry
work.
Merry Christmas.
The recording will be up on our website. And the fact is that's where all the traffic comes from, the numbers sometimes.
In the next day or so. Uh-huh.